Hello! Hello and welcome back to this community radio show and podcast if you're catching up with us after our live broadcast. On today's episode, we have some lovely songs now that we are with Alphabet Radio. So that is a wonderful addition for you. We have our Swap It Like It's Hot Media Club feature where you can join in giving us our views on, as we go back in time and look at old queer media, books, films, music, anything like that. And then we have a really, really special interview with a wonderful person, a journalist and documentary maker called Freddie McConnell, as we hear more about his court case and how that impacts on all of our queer parenting rights. But first, Shah, how you doing? How's this week been for you?
Oh, I've missed you this week, Lex. I've been all, like, tired, and I listened to your Cuddle Club, and it's exactly what I needed, so thank you for that. How are you?
See, when we'd last recorded, I was in that, like, tired, lethargic mood, but actually this has been a really upbeat and positive week for me.
I feel like we've swapped.
We have.
We've swapped it like it's hot in literal sense as well.
We have done very good. What have you been, like, doing to keep sane during lockdown this week?
I've been working, and that's why I'm so tired, because I've got to that place where, you know, I'm always talking about balance and having a happy medium. Well, guilty this week, have not done that. Burnt myself out. I've been working too much. I think sometimes just because this lockdown, it's quite difficult to gauge time. So I've just been like trying to take as much work on as possible, but then it's kind of not held me in good stead this week. I've actually done a bit enough, a bit more than I could chew, actually, Lex.
Oh, babe.
I feel like I definitely need a Lexington hug.
I'll give you a massive big bear hug. The balance is really, really tough to get through at the moment because, oh my God, there's nothing to delineate between the week and the weekend. It all just blurs into
it's
one.
It's like that time after Christmas. Like, I even put on one of my Instagram stories the other day. I was like, happy Sunday. And everyone was like messaging me saying, sure, it's Saturday.
Oops. See, fortunately, a very good friend of mine, shout out to Andrew Brennan, always posts like days of the week while topless. Like, it's like, whatever his workout has done. It's like Monday, Tuesday, and genuinely that's how I know which day of the week it is.
I feel like that would work for you, but not so much for me. But yeah, shout out Andrew Brennan. Thanks for the abs. Absolutely.
So, do you want to introduce our first song choice?
I do, actually. And I think this is one of the songs that it's either you love it at the moment or you hate it because you are sick of the TikTok challenges. But the reason I chose this song is because I think visibility, and I know you do too, is really important. And so the Don't Rush challenge, I don't know if you've seen it on TikTok.
I'm an old person. I'm not on TikTok.
Okay, I'm going to send you all of the videos. But they're basically, they're like glow up challenges. My favourite one is brown people do drag. So it's all of these brown drag artists, and they start off in their normal sort of everyday clothes, and then they clean the camera with their blusher brush, and then they appear as these beautiful drag artists. So
okay.
I'm going to send you the video, but the song that goes along with it is called Don't Rush, and it's by, I believe, Young T.
This is Alphabet Radio.
Don't rush, slow touch.
So that was Don't Rush by Young T, and I'm sure loads of you out there have either completed a Don't Rush challenge or seen one, unless you're Lex and you've been living in hiding, it would seem.
No, I'm too old for TikTok. I joined it for a couple of hours and then I was like, no, it's not for me. Like, one social media thing is enough.
Maybe I'm going to teach you a TikTok dance. Right, Alphabet Radio poll will decide, should I teach Lex a TikTok dance? Because I feel like you'd be great at it. I feel like you're a savage. Nasty, bougie, ratchet.
I'd say that someone being a savage is even a bit of, like, slang that I'm not even understanding. Anyway, it is time for our new favourite feature, Swap It Like It's Hot.
The pimps in the crib, ma. Swap it like it's hot.
Swap it like it's hot.
Swap it like it's hot. Every time you say that, I just want to do the dance. So, Lex, last week I asked you to look at one of my teenage faves. And I'm saying teenage faves because I recently rewatched it and I had a little bit of a different opinion. But you watched Sugar Rush season 1, How do you get on?
So I can really remember watching it as a teenager, much like you, and the excitement that I had when watching it, and kind of like, oh my God, there's like a another like gay person on TV. Even though she was a girl and not a gay boy, I still kind of was like, oh my God, some sort of vague representation of someone who's slightly more like me. And then rewatching it, I expected to have this like really warm, lovely nostalgia, which started. And then by episode two, I was like, oh God.
Oh my goodness.
This is not aged well.
This is not okay with me anymore.
She's trying to date her friend. Oh God. Right. She's going through conversion therapy. Oh, okay. And they're now drinking and smoking and doing drugs at 15. Right. We're in a different place now, aren't we?
That's literally the sort of surprise that I had when I rewatched it, because I sat there with Grace and I was like, oh, let's rewatch this together. It'll be really romantic and nostalgic. And we were like, date? Did she just date? Are they? Is this?
Yeah.
Is this?
And it's not actually that old now. Well, I guess it's 15 years.
It's 15 years, so it is, whilst that makes us feel old, it makes me sound old, but it is still like very like relevant. Mm. And when I watched it back, I remember growing up thinking that, you know, Sugar was this sort of queer, almost like woman of colour icon. Mm-hmm. And then watching it back, I was like, hang on a minute, she wasn't actually even queer.
No.
She wasn't the kid. And when I sort of thought about how I had, like, let, I suppose, Sugar Rush influence me as a young queer woman, it kind of reinforced the idea that people of colour weren't queer, actually. And there wasn't that much visibility. So when I looked back, I was like, wow, this really had an impact on me that I didn't actually realise. But it just sort of confirmed that in that queer world, I wasn't supposed to be there. It just made it even more of a taboo.
I get that. And I think the it's a very strange one, because in one sense, it did a great job of kind of normalizing that questioning bit. Mm. And it was deeply emotional when she like finally plucked up the courage to tell Sugar how she felt about her and admit that she had feelings for her that were romantic. And we all had a crush on a straight friend at some point in our teens, and loads of us must have gone through that thinking and thought process of like, oh, if I say something or things were different, maybe we could be together. And actually, no, because your sexualities are not the same.
And I love the way that it plays with that. I just didn't remember it being so dark.
Mm.
I remembered it to be really fun, and I remember it being based in Brighton, and they would go out to the beach and the pier, and it was bright lights, and I completely dismissed there was this whole other thing. And it might have been because I watched it from a young age, so I wasn't even aware of those things.
I didn't realise at the time how many drink and drug references there were in it, but now watching it back, I'm like, oh my God, like, that they are young and they're like going in and out of clubs and they're doing ecstasy and drinking, and like every scene they are smoking. And it's just, I don't feel it has aged as well as my memory of it.
And that's exactly, I'm 100% with you with those sentiments. I was shocked, but then also at the same time, it just made me realise why, you know, we do what we do, why we fight to have sober, clear, queer spaces, and why it's so important to us to be able to use our platforms to aid the community, because there is that stereotype. And I think sometimes it's not just a stereotype. We do have more trauma in our community. We do have higher levels of alcoholism and abuse and trauma. So, you know, that sort of, as a sort of warning or a trigger, I think that was really almost a nice reminder for me that our community is so fragile in some senses.
And I think especially because a lot of queer people end up meeting and making their first relationships through the club and
the clubs,
scene.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you go to the scene, and as soon as you come out, someone says, oh, I'll take you to the scene.
Yeah, and maybe this is an age thing that's changing now, like maybe younger generations coming up behind us are actually going to be, their first experience of it is really going to be through social media. But for us, it was definitely, you actually made your first IRL.
Yeah.
queer friends at clubs and bars.
Clubs, yeah.
And you'd like see the other young ones and be like, oh, we're going to be friends.
Yeah, the mutual thing to do was drink, wasn't it? But
okay, so
I'm glad that you enjoyed it. So thanks for watching it.
Okay, so is this going to be a piece of queer media that you save from the flames as our society and civilization burns? Is this something you save for it to be held sacred forevermore? Or is this going to be something that you quietly let go away?
I think for educational purposes, we should save it, but it should come with a very strict disclaimer and warning.
Okay. And then next, I made you watch one of my all-time favourite films, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. How on earth did you find it? What did you think of it?
So, at first watch, I was really sort of in awe of the origin of love, because that is
stunning.
Just all me, and the masculine and feminine energy, and that whole the play on the story and the song, it all seemed so beautiful. And then as I watched it more and more, I loved the theatre of it, I loved the music in it, I loved the styling. But then when I looked at the characters, there was one bit that I couldn't get past, and it was the sugar daddy.
Mm-hmm.
This, like, at the time, I can imagine how that would have been a real, like, change maker
mm-hmm.
in queer culture. But now looking back, I look at that part of the film, and it's just a little bit, you know, the work that I do with UK Black Pride is about the stereotypes in, we discuss a lot about the stereotypes of Black people of colour in the queer community, and this black predatory older man is quite a stereotypical character that we see and that we fight against. So I really struggled after I saw that to get past it,
mm-hmm.
because that was something that, you know, personally for me, I could see how it was part of the story, but it triggered me just as a person of colour and mm-hmm. having experienced that kind of stereotyping.
I guess, yeah, it's not great that the one man of colour in it, like, comes in quite a...
Is a sugar daddy, like, literally,
well, comes
gummy
in
bears.
In, like, this sexualised hero, and then leaves, kind of, like,
leaves.
Two scenes later.
Yeah, and I loved how the film sort of used the culture that was happening at the time to sort of emulate the story and the feelings, like when the Berlin Wall falls down and she's just in the trailer and he's just left and she's watching it. I loved how it sort of brought you along with the story.
Because I find that moment heartbreaking, because of course in the timeline, if she just waited a couple of more months, she would have been free.
Yeah, completely free. And I think that's one of the things that really tugged me as well, because I've got loads of trans friends. Especially trans women, like really close to a few of my trans women friends. And just the song, I just found the lyrics were really uncomfortable.
Which ones?
What did the lyrics? They said, 6 inches forward, 5 inches back,
yeah.
I've got an angry inch.
Right, yeah.
Just about the botched surgery.
Mm-hmm.
That made me feel uncomfortable, but I can see how in its time it's just really new and really explorative and really interesting. But for me, watching that now, in the community now, I was like, this is amazing and problematic all in one film.
Yeah, I think I think given that we have picked two of our old favourites and brought them back with like new modern lenses, I think we're probably going to find that so much old stuff that we used to like is now considered quite problematic.
But I love the music, like Martin from the Martini Hour. He messaged me as soon as he heard the show and he was like, I literally just dyed my hair listening to the soundtrack from Hedwig. So it's still iconic. People are still like ensnared in the story of it.
And I think it's also a very uplifting and powerful story, I think. And if you take it a bit less literally, I think there's a message for all of us in there that we can kind of all identify with in some ways. Of like, you're kind of going from the person you were to this transformation into who you become and getting out of whatever place that you were. And for me, listening to it, watching that at kind of like age 16 in my like shitty suburban hometown, where I was the only gay kid and also the only alternative gay kid, like having this punk rock queer icon to look up to who went through this transformation, escaped where they were from, and then kind of like became this, had their redemption and also found themselves. And what I loved is that it wasn't a love story where they got their happy ending by falling for someone else. They got their love story by realizing that they were whole.
Yeah, that I was going to say, that is the part of the film, the story, that I really love, because you know how I like to be spiritual and woo-woo. Mm-hmm. We can lol about it. But there's a part in the film where Tommy Gnosis is talking about Adam and Eve, and he says, it's almost as though he's saying that the masculine and feminine was always just one whole being. And mm-hmm. then God ripped out Eve, ripped out what I took as the feminine energy from the one soul to explore and to find knowledge. And that is almost, you know, it really represents the journey that we all go on with battle, especially in the queer community. There's always this tussle between masculine and feminine energy, and does that equate to gender, and does that equate to sexuality, and does that equate to how we represent physically? So I love the way that that sort of made something really non-linear, and there's that more sort of spiritual take on it. That's how I looked at it anyway.
Yeah. And it's, so will we save it? I want to save it. I think it's an incredibly important piece of film. And also, remember, it was a Broadway show as well. And because it just got such a wonderful survival and self-reliance and uplifting message to it, the storytelling in it, the way it weaves in mythology into it as well, the songs, like, I think it's a stunning, beautiful thing. Is it perfect? No. And interestingly, when it came back to Broadway about 5 years ago, Sugar Daddy character wasn't in it.
Oh,
so that was how they kind of updated it in a modern way. But I think it's an incredibly empowering and beautiful film that gives a really special view on queer love.
So we're definitely saving it then.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch is saved.
Saved. So what are we swapping this week?
So this week is a book. It is.
Oh, yeah. You're going to make me read.
I'm going to make you read. We are all getting far too much screen time at the moment. We're always on our phones. We're always on our laptops. We're always watching Netflix. So I'm going to say, everyone, put down your phone, put down your, turn off the TV and Netflix, and pick up Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. Now, Tales of the City is the first installment in a really, really decades-long running queer series by this guy Armistead Maupin. It starts in 1978 in San Francisco. And you might have heard the phrase, as queer people, we get to choose our families, and we have logical families rather than biological families. Have you heard that?
Yes. Well, at UK Black Pride, we call it our chosen family.
So that comes from this book series. Armistead Maupin was the writer who coined that phrase and lots of other things. And it's this wonderful, it's set in 1970s San Francisco. That's where it starts. And it's
San Fran. It's has to love it.
A whole group of queer people from different identities and expressions, all coming together at this one woman's house, Mrs. Madrigal. And she's kind of the matriarch of this made chosen family. And there's a book every decade from the 1970s up until now. And it charts and describes some really pivotal moments in LGBT history from a characterized first person perspective. And I think it was ahead of its time in terms of race and sexuality and just telling these stories in a really beautiful way. So that is Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. You only have to read the first book in the series.
How many books are there?
If I were to check on my bookshelf, I'd say there are at least 8.
Okay.
Probably more.
So I have to read a book.
You do.
I'm here for that. Thank you. Thanks for that. I'm looking forward to that. I actually have a reading list that I just recently looked at, and I've just started ordering books from it. So I can add it to the list. Thanks.
And what are you recommending for me this week?
So this week, I would like you to listen to an EP.
Ooh.
And this is by an American musician called King Princess.
Okay.
So she's young. She's only 21. She's born in 98. So she's a brand new, we call her, she's one of the lesbian Jesuses. So there's Hayley Kiyoko, King Princess. There's a few lesbian Jesuses. And her music is really sort of poppy, edgy. It's sort of like the music that defines lesbian life now. She openly talks about women in all of her lyrics. She's got song called Pussy is God, which I'm sure you will love.
Brilliant.
And I just want you to have a listen. For me, it makes me want to sort of dance, and it makes me really want to celebrate, because I know I can be so serious. And I know that I often get that sit shy, you're being so serious. So I just wanted to have something fun that makes me feel really happy and really just rainbowy queer. So have
Lovely.
A listen, let me know what you think.
Okay, I shall do. And as we just had a recommendation for a song from Shah, I think it is time that we go for another record. This is Queen of the Rodeo by Orville Peck. I've picked it because Orville Peck is a gay Canadian country singer. And he also, interestingly, doesn't show his face. He wears a mask. And right now I have a massive, massive spot right on the front of my face, and wish I could wear a mask as well. So this is Queen of the Rodeo by Orville Peck.
Another evening show, Queen of the Rodeo.
So that was Queen of the Rodeo by Orville Peck. Absolute tunes. Lex, I'm really pleased with your tune selections.
Thank
I can't believe how well we're
babe.
Getting on with it. So, moving on, as we said at the top of the show and at the top of our new radio, Community Podcast is dedicated to bringing stories to the community that are really important and that we should all be knowledgeable about and really open to learning more about. We were so privileged to have a very special guest on our show last week. We've started doing Zoom calls from home, so we literally had Freddie McConnell in the closet under his stairs. He is best known as the dad who gave birth, and we had a really great conversation with them all about their recent legal battle in court, fighting for the right to be named father on the birth certificate. I hope you guys enjoy.
Alphabet.
Hey, Freddie, thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. It's nice to be here in my cupboard.
Yeah, joining us from a very glamorous recording location.
I'm mostly just hiding from the kid. That actually isn't for sound quality. But it's nice. We've been in the garden and doing some cooking and, yeah, classic lockdown stuff.
Oh, I hear you. I have spent all of today cleaning and cooking, and then someone's like, oh, we have a radio show to do.
Yeah. Do you guys always record on a Sunday afternoons?
It depends on like our guest availability. So a mix of different times. But we also have the lovely Shah on as well. Give us a wave and a hello, Shah.
Hiya, Freddie.
Hello.
Okay. So you are here today to talk to us about quite a big topic, which thank you so much for joining us, because it's something which Shah and I both, as we have started to enter into our 30s, is becoming increasingly personal to us. And that is about alternative ways of being a queer parent and what that means if you are going to want to be a parent, but outside of this heteronormative, cisgendered mother and a father and 2.4 kids. And so as right now, you are in the news because sadly you have just lost first stage of a court case to be recognised as your child's father on their birth certificate, rather than being as known, put down on paper as their mother, because you were born as a woman, but however, you are a trans man. And so you are arguing that your birth certificate label should match up with your genuine gender of a man. That's a fair enough kind of like quick summary of it.
Yeah, I guess two things. Well, my specific situation is that I have a GRC, so that the legal arguments that we're making are on that basis. That's important to clarify. So for anyone, obviously, I think I'm right in saying that most trans people in the UK don't have a GRC. It's quite a laborious and some would say outdated system. But I do have one, which means that legally my gender is male and my sex, actually. There's no differentiation between sex and gender when it comes to the GRA. Are both legally male, quote, for all purposes. So a lot of the arguments rest on that specific language. And can I just say, I always cringe massively when people say born a woman, because it's
I'm so sorry.
No one's born a woman. It's totally not. It's fine. I'm not at all annoyed. It just genuinely makes me laugh. I don't know where that phrase came from, but it's so hilarious.
It is, and we have to do so much relearning of a lot of the gendered language that we use.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things that came out of Alexa and I's conversation was that we really need to usualise or normalise, depending on which term you prefer, but we need to get used to saying, I don't know enough about this, and I'm really open to learning about it, and we are getting so much better, I think, at holding our hands up and actually doing what community set out to do and passing the mic over to the people who have that lived experience and can speak on it, because we can only sort of give our perspective or our opinion or our thought based on, you know, our individual experience, and that's, you know, only coaxed by ourselves. So it's really important for us to, you know, really make sure that we set the scene with this conversation that, you know, we don't know enough, and we are really open to learning more from you. So if we can keep that as a theme, that'd be really helpful.
It is. And again, apologies that we are going to get things wrong. And as soon as you said that, I like kicked myself because I was like, oh my God, no. Because my friend who was trans was like, no, it's AFAB, assigned female at birth. Anyway. So
although weirdly, actually this conversation around the court case, I will get onto it, right? But like, it applies to all trans people. So people think it's talked about in the news as a story of a pregnant man wanting to be the father. And actually we've uncovered that there's a much bigger issue here in terms of the legal recognition of trans people when they become parents. So.
Well, that's really interesting, because I'm also wondering, as a gay man who does want to be a father later on, actually what the ramifications for me, if I were to be in a same-sex couple having a child, could potentially be. Anyway, before we get to that, we will start why I and Shah first became kind of like aware of you. So you did that beautiful and touching documentary called Seahorse. And I can't speak for Shah, so I'm just going to speak for myself here. That was an amazing piece of documentary. So thank you so much for allowing the world into that deeply personal experience that you went through of trying to become pregnant and then your actual experience during that and then giving birth as well. I just, it was so touching. And right at the start, you say, not only women feel broody, and that just like got me right in the gut, because like, oh my God, I totally feel that. And also I totally know that my like 67-year-old father also feels quite broody again. He's desperate for me to have kids so he can be a grandfather.
It's so lovely. It's such a nice thing to talk about when men do talk about that and like feel that they can express it. And I don't say all men feel that at all, but just it's like this like secret club. Like, yeah, so many of us do feel that, I think, but we're a bit afraid to talk about it. And like the experience of fatherhood and being a primary carer as a man has been really interesting, and like the whole side of this again I think is slightly missed in the conversation.
I was so intrigued watching it, because you can see that it's almost like, I think whenever you like watch a piece of art, it's always about being able to feel alongside that person, and you could feel every emotion. I watched you talk about feeling uncomfortable at the thought of just having tampons in your bag, and then just imagining that And I can only imagine and be an observer that, you know, when it came to that time of actually having to birth or bring this child into the world, how difficult or how did you navigate that? How, like, psychologically?
Well, first I just want to shout out the director, Jeannie Finley, who I think her storytelling is the thing that is enabling you to feel that empathy. I think, you know, she selected those moments to reflect a universality and an everydayness, which, you know, might sound really boring, but that's kind of the biggest feedback we've had from audiences of all kinds watching the film. It's just like, it's the detail. It's like, this is just an ordinary life. It's just talked about historically in such a sensational way. So yeah, and I think that's what she deliberately set out to do and achieved so wonderfully. And in terms of the birth, I mean, my mum has been a huge support for me throughout my whole life, but definitely throughout that process of trying to start a family.
Yeah, she looks brilliant.
You can really tell. She's literally that, I want a grandbaby. Give me my grandbabies. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, and she always really talked about pregnancy and birth as a really positive experience in a non-gendered way. With, like, she didn't, even before, like, years before she knew I was trans, and even I realized I was trans, you know, when I was a kid, even she would say things like, oh, I think all people should be able to experience, wouldn't it be wonderful if all people would experience this, because it's such a great thing, and it's so it would just be so lovely. And so I had a very positive conception of birth and pregnancy, and I found pregnancy really hard, but birth itself, I don't know, you, like, it's the most intense experience I think it's capable for a human being to have, especially, I mean, that is if it goes to plan and it goes positively, and obviously, like, it often doesn't, so I want to say, like, even that feels like a privilege that I did have the experience I wanted. And yeah, it, like, it beats any drug, it beats any fucking bungee jump, sorry, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, it beats any, like, skydive, whatever, like, it's incredible. So actually, I don't think, I was in a dark room in a pool, like, at that point, all the kind of gendered language that I'd been battling or having to face.
And having to literally scribble out and rewrite for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. That all just fell away, and I felt very safe, and I was with my mum, and I'd had brilliant conversations with a couple of friends who were doulas in the lead up to it, and I'd read books, and I felt like I owned that experience in a way that, yeah, just made it very private, which is odd because it's obviously on a film. But, you know, actually also I didn't really notice the camera in that moment. Like, my memory of that experience is so different from what you see in the film, which I really love. Like, there's almost a complete separation of those two things, which is perfect, really. So I'm really glad it was captured, but also that I have this different memory and different kind of sense memory of it.
It's funny that you say that doesn't match up with your memory, because it feels so personal. So I've never had the privilege of seeing someone give birth. I've heard a lot about it. My best mate, she's a midwife. And similarly to your mother, my mum spoke incredibly positively and openly about the experience of pregnancy and giving birth. And I can remember as a little kid being quite sad that I wouldn't have the experience of pregnancy and birthing because of how amazingly and positively she spoke about it. So watching it, I was blown away by it.
Oh, I watched lots of One Born Every Minute.
I'm literally the opposite. I see One Born every minute and I feel like everything contracts and I just go stiff and I'm like a deer in headlights. So literally, no, I'm going to pass that over to my partner. She can do all of that, because I just feel completely the opposite. But one thing that struck me is that you said, you know, it felt like such a privilege to be able to do it the way that you wanted to. And I know you mentioned speaking to a doula, which I just love because, you know, they are spiritually those people who help bring life in. So I know you said that in your documentary it was difficult filling out forms, and as a person of colour I felt that as well, when you fill out a form and what you know who you are doesn't quite fit. And for me, sort of the remedy for that has been sort of creating, like, my own sort of space where I've, like, as people of colour, we do creator space. So I'm just wondering, you know, there's lots of non-binary young people now. In the meantime, is there a way that a space can be created so that men who have babies do feel included and less erased? Is that an option?
I think my experience didn't take like reinventing the wheel to make me feel comfortable. It just took kind people like doing their job, like not being sidetracked by the slightly, you know, the unique or unusual detail of who I was. So that gives me hope. I think it wouldn't take lots of training and separate spaces and things like that necessarily. And actually, wonderfully, there's two midwives in Brighton who have drafted the first ever set of guidelines, including a kind of language guide for trans and non-binary birthing parents. And I think that training, that guide is going to be rolled out and used in their trust, and I don't see any reason why it couldn't be rolled out across the country. So I think things are happening, and also there are queer doulas now. I actually found it really hard to find any queer doulas specifically when I was going through pregnancy, but since then I think they've become more visible and are becoming ever more visible. And yeah, I mean, I found it really helpful to write a birth plan and had got amazing guidance from my NHS midwife about that and how detailed I could be and how specific. And again, obviously if something goes wrong, that kind of all goes out the window. So there is a huge element of luck and even just luck in who's on duty. And so, you know, like, I don't think you're ever going to be able to completely control it at all, but yeah, having a birth plan. And I mean, I don't know. Also, it's hard for me to speak to actually, even, you know, despite obviously having parts of my identity that kind of make me vulnerable, I still am a white man. And I think that still played a role actually in my being treated the way I wanted to be. And people not second guessing me, or so it's this kind of weird paradox where, like, I'm about to give birth and I'm very vulnerable and I'm feeling like, you know, something traumatic might happen here, but actually I am also being treated with this weird respect that's just like the privilege of being a white man and a white person. So it's weird, you know, and I don't ever want to forget that. But yeah, like I said, I think the key thing is just, like, you don't have to be a magician or anyone special if you're, like, in a caring role, and just carry on being caring and like, hopefully the person will have a good experience.
I love that, carry on caring. I think it sounds like a very British solution.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you ever feel, when you were in those spaces, like at a maternity clinic, I can only say my experience because I was my mum's birthing partner. So you know, I went to her, you know, classes with her, went to the appointments, I was her birthing partner, like, so I was there for the birth. And, you know, as a queer woman I'm a bit of a tomboy generally, I felt uncomfortable in those spaces. It's like, you know, it's very pink and feminine. Did you ever feel the need to assert yourself as a man in those spaces, to be accepted in those spaces, or were you just always, you know, aware of the privilege that you've mentioned?
So I very rarely found myself in those spaces, to be honest. My community midwife came to my house for all of our appointments, and that was something that she offered at that outset, which is again just a sign of how lucky I was to have her as my midwife. And she's actually someone that my parents know from years back, like, because I live in quite a small town. So I very much wanted to avoid having to go to any appointments that would be in a, you know, labor ward or maternity unit. And I think when I went for my scans, apart from one, they were all with the same sonographer who was queer herself and had been, like, identified by my midwife as being a cool person, and she, like, agreed to do all my scans. So I just had a wonderful experience. And yeah, like, those are things I would recommend. Like, you can ask your midwife to come and see you at home, and they should do that. And if they don't, offering on midwife and that kind of thing. And I had one bad experience where I had to go for a sort of unplanned late stage scan, and everything fell apart at that point, and it was really awful. Not so much because of the totally because of the gender stuff, but not because of, it was like just someone acted really horribly in a way they shouldn't have, in the way, in a way that was unprofessional. It was less to do with, I don't know, yeah, like stereotypes and stuff like that. I just tried to be, I didn't feel like I was strong enough at that time to actually counter any stuff that could have happened, like, which is why I wanted people to visit me at home and to not, I just tried to avoid those situations from the outset.
That's understandable.
Like, yeah. Well, couldn't really be like assertive.
But it sounds like you had some, while there was that unfortunately negative experience, it sounds like actually there were some really good moments of people being good, decent humans and continuing to be professionals, but also a couple of nice moments of other queer people from the community stepping in and around you as a community kind of should operate. So that sounds quite nice. And so your lovely child is born and you see this beautiful, touching moment, and then what should just be the start of the privilege, pleasure and pain of parenting should go in, but you then have to go through a legal case. Could you just tell listeners a recap of what your case is and where you are now with it, please?
Sure. So this isn't in the film, obviously. The filming stopped after the birth. And then, so way before I conceived and even made the firm decision to carry my own child, I had been doing some research and saw on a Facebook group for, I don't know, trans men or people, queer people starting their families. Someone just said, oh, like, does anyone know what the situation is in the UK? I know, like, at the moment that we have to register as mother. And I was like, what? And I'd never known that. I had just always naively assumed that, like, you could just put yourself down as father and no one would really ask questions. Like, I didn't realize there were strict rules, I guess, and definitions about who could be down as what. And I assumed that, you know, like if you had two dads, then they would both go down as father. Or if you had two mums, they would both go down as mother. And I now know that was or is or not the case. And it's much more of a kind of bolted together, like I want to say, slightly Frankensteined birth registration system that in some ways is progressive because it lets people be registered as parents, but actually it's still delineates and restricts these labels of mother and father for a very specific single group of people in each case. So that would mean that once I would try to go and register my son, I would have to go down as mother, and I didn't feel like I could sort of just accept that without exploring the possibility of challenging it. And I felt like I could challenge it potentially because I, again, was privileged enough to be working for The Guardian at the time, and so I could go to one of our lawyers in-house and just say, hey, there's this situation, do you know anyone I could possibly talk to that handles this kind of case? And I was put in touch with someone who put me in touch with someone, and I ended up with an incredible legal team working 100% pro bono, which I don't think there's many, you know, like that's a really, even though obviously it's really hard and stressful doing the court case, to be in a position where I could bring those people together is unusual, and it's in itself a privilege. So I'm glad that I'm able to do this, because I know there's many trans dads and younger trans men who haven't had kids yet who are really freaked out by it, and many who say it's the reason they won't have kids, and or they'll have kids some another way, which isn't to say that another way isn't just as valid, but people who want to carry should be able to, and stuff like that shouldn't put them off. So I just felt like I couldn't. Sorry.
No, that's good to say. And so from my perspective as a cisgendered man, my ignorance and my privilege as being a cisgendered person, I kind of can only logically understand it rather than the emotional understanding. And so my understanding of why being down as the father rather than down the rather than mother is from point of view, like, well, you are a man, you are the father. And then if ever the child has to use their birth certificate for identification, something like that, that then would out you as their parent. in your own words, why is it important? Because I can logically understand, as I said, but my status as a cis person means I'd like to understand it from your point of view better.
Yeah, I think the outing thing is something that the government have argued in court, and the government is the sort of other side of the case. So it's sort of me versus the government, or like various bits of the government. And it's a bit of an odd one, because I think I can see with, you know, no offense or anything, but like, I think that is a kind of cis perspective on it. It's like,
fair.
For me, the outing isn't an issue. It's right. Like, of course, I am my child's parent and father, and I gave birth to him. That's never going to be a secret, and it's never something I would want to hide, apart from potentially in if we were traveling somewhere that where it was a risk and I had his birth certificate. I don't know why I would, you know, that sort of thing. Very specific mm-hmm. situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not something. And actually, I've always thought that if I was looking and sounding as I do with my name and my M on my passport, and then to be listed as mother, to me, is, you know, it's not outing, so it's just definitely stranger and would out me, I think, actually, more directly than being listed as father, because there are all sorts of ways in which I can be his father without having given birth to him, and without having a mother on a certificate, you know, and in all the ways that we can create families nowadays in all sorts of countries where you can have birth certificates like that, where there's only one parent. We are actually arguing, I mean, I'd be happy with father or parent. That's the idea. So I think ultimately, in the long run, it would be a better system if everyone was listed as parent one, parent two, and then you'd have some kind of, you could have some kind of way of making it so that it's clear who gave birth without that person having to be listed as mother.
So do you think they should get rid of mother and father and just have parent one, parent two, and then something to identify which parent gave birth?
Well, one of the funny technicalities of a court case is that we don't actually, the court case isn't going to be deciding what the remedy is. The court is being asked to decide whether there is something that needs fixing, and then it's for the government and parliament to decide what the fix would be. So I think there's lots of potential solutions, as we can see all over the world, in places where it is all gender neutral, or in places where you have specific birth certificate for a specific class of people. You know, in this country, we have parental orders for surrogacy. So if you were to have a kid through surrogacy, you don't go down on the birth certificate. The parents don't go on the birth certificate. The surrogate goes on the birth certificate, and potentially the surrogate's husband goes on the birth certificate, which I find very strange. But the parents go on something called a parental order, which they have to go to court to get, and they have to have a child protection officer come visit them at home, and they go down as parent one and parent two. And likewise, if you have a lesbian couple, you have mother and parent two. So we already have parents on birth certificates, but they can only be the female partner of a woman, or I suppose person that gave birth. So it's very strange. The layout is currently a bit of a mess, I would say. And but yeah, there's all sorts of options. So yeah, I'd let Parliament decide that. But just basically what we're asking is for them to acknowledge that trans people have never been taken into account when any of this legislation has been written, including on the Gender Recognition Act, where there was really no discussion of the fact that trans people could become parents post-transition or post-GRC, as opposed to children who already existed before a person transitioned.
So you must have thought about this for, like, you know, we've been sort of trying to comprehend it and trying to empathize and look at it from different angles for, you know, since you've met, like, been in the media and since this story's been so important. But, like, if we had a magic wand, what would your answer be? What would the solution be? What would you say?
Well, it's kind of actually tricky for me to talk about that, like, because I can't, that's still to be decided. If we, you know, this isn't actually the first step of the case. We were at the High Court, and then we were at the Appeal Court, and then the next step would be the Supreme Court. And we're currently applying to the Supreme Court to take the case there. And I just can't, I don't think it's sensible for me to talk about what our desired outcome is, given that it's still a live issue. So I can talk about sort of theories, but I'm not going to express an exact desire.
Can you talk about what you think would be, I don't know, advisable or recommended or best for, like, you, the trans community, or just the queer parents as a whole?
I think just equal recognition. I think it's really odd that the definition of a mother under the common law is the person that gives birth. Like, that affects me, but it also affects all sorts of cis women and all sorts of other, all sorts of people, trans women, you know, all sorts of people that are mothers day to day. That is their social and legal reality. They cannot be registered as mothers on birth certificates, because not even deliberately, but over the years, this definition has emerged in that way. It does through in English law, where it sort of just becomes that through it being that, as opposed to there being anywhere in the legislation that says this is the definition of mother. Yeah, I just think it's odd that if you are the mum who hasn't given birth in a lesbian relationship, then you can't be registered as mother. You have to be registered as parent too. Likewise, if you're a father, a gay father, and there's two gay fathers, neither of whom gave birth, then you can't be registered as father. You have to be registered as parent. So yeah, all these little quirks of the system. And yet, if you're a guy who is just married to someone who was someone's surrogate, you can register as the father, even if you have no genetic or familial relationship to the child. And then you're on that child's birth certificate for the rest of their lives, and you were just the surrogate's partner. I mean, when I don't know, that it just seems all just so
tangled.
Cishet.
And quite outdated as well for the realities.
So outdated.
Very archaic.
Yeah, for the realities of what kind of, like, modern families can and enough in many cases do look like.
Yeah. And so whereas actually, a lot of places it has really kept up, like places like Canada and Australia, they have kept up, and we haven't. And I think this, my case, has sort of shed light on all this in a way that I didn't think it would at all. I really thought we were just going to court to see, so that people like me could be registered as fathers or parents. But so then there's this other issue that actually I really do want to quickly explain, in case there's any trans people listening who might already be registered or who are in relationships where, like, so trans men who wouldn't give birth, but who are married to cis women who do give birth, and the man and they might be married, and in that situation, I don't think anyone would argue that that man shouldn't be registered as the father, because they are a man, so they have their GRC. I mean, they're a man anyway, but legally they've been recognized as a man with their GRC and they're married to their wife. They would be registered as the father, surely. Well, actually, in court, the government, in order to sort of justify its position, argued that no trans person can be registered in anything but their gender assigned at birth.
Wow.
On their child's birth certificate. So that man, that father, would have to be registered as parent too, which is a term exclusively used for female partners of women that give birth. Wow. Likewise, a trans woman who was in a lesbian relationship and her partner gave birth, she wouldn't be allowed to register as parent too. She'd have to register as the father, even if it wasn't her sperm that was used in the process. Like, so that, again, is like, when that happened, it was like, it was just like an earthquake. I felt like nothing was real anymore, because surely the government can't be arguing that. It's not just men who give birth. This is about trans people not being registered. So effectively, it's like, we'll recognize your transition and your gender up until the point when you become a parent, at which point it becomes invalid. And that, to me, kind of seems like de facto sterilization. You know, you might not be doing operations on people, but you're saying that we won't recognize you if you become a parent, which is going to stop a lot of people becoming parents.
Well, and as you say, it also, there are still legal barriers to same-sex parenting certification of that.
Yes.
And it is just another way that equality is withheld from people who are LGBTQ. And of course, this comes at a time when Liz Truss recently announced that she was going to repeal, totally remove healthcare for young trans people. And so what you're actually doing is having to fight against this tide where the government is kind of quite consciously moving things backwards in ways that they can.
The Liz Truss's statement is very worrying, and obviously the past few years have been unrelentingly grim and disheartening. And when we started the case, it wasn't quite like that. I think we were just on the cusp of it all kind of starting, and actually at the time the Conservative government had just released their consultation on the GRA, the Gender Recognition Act, which initially was, you know, very promising and not radical, but very sensible and carefully considered, and they'd gone through everything. And I think it was almost like the beginning of our case coincided with the moment at which we realized that that was being sabotaged. And I guess I'm really glad that we are in the legal system, and I just have to have faith, as opposed to in a political system with the case, and I have to have faith that that will prevail even when we get very conservative judgments, not, you know, small-c conservative judgments like the appeal judgment. Feels like it's written in a very conservative way, a very kind of like black and white reading of the law that already exists, that was written in 1950, blah. And
So unfortunately we do have to wrap up now, because I know you've got to go. You have a child who is trying to get to you to look
literally,
up.
Literally, you need him like bang.
It's interesting though, because when Shah and I started to research about this, I didn't anticipate that actually one person's legal case could have such wide ramifications for anybody who is LGBTQ, whether you are cisgendered or transgendered. What if you had a message to the wider LGBT community on this subject? What would that be?
I've got this podcast actually coming out on BBC Sounds later in the month, called Pride and Joy, and the whole thrust of that is really to celebrate all the amazing, challenging, surprising, you know, creative ways that queer people are becoming parents. And I think despite what I'm going through, I would just want to reassert that none of that should stop you, and none of, you know, a birth certificate doesn't define me, doesn't define my relationship to my child, and nor does it define anyone's relationship to their children, especially in this country where they're so outdated. You know, we have to have birth certificates. They are important legal documents, which is why this fight is worth having. But I don't want to get to imbue this birth certificate with some sort of power that it doesn't have, you know. So obviously all the trans dads out there who are registered as mother, sucks, but my god, it doesn't take away from the beauty of those relationships and the equal value of those families amongst all other families. And just obviously don't let legal bullshit get in the way of you realizing your dream of a family. And there's lots of community out there, there's lots of resources nowadays, there's lots of wonderful books that you can buy when you become a parent and read with your kid and feel very affirmed and reflected. And even the latest series of like Kung Fu Panda has queer parents, you know. It's 99.9% of the time a wonderful thing that you should go after if you want to. And you know, the legal stuff will catch up eventually.
And it will eventually catch up, and it does take incredibly strong-willed and brave people like you to put that forward. And I know it's cringe whenever you say someone is brave for doing something which is just right for them, but I think thank you for going through an uncomfortable thing that will make it better for a lot of other people. And on that, we will let you go. Thank you so much for joining us today and for talking so openly about us. It is a subject which we are woefully uneducated on, and conversations like these really, really help us all understand. So thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thanks so much. Don't forget to just give yourself a little plug as well. Let people know they can find your documentary if they want to watch it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, the best place to keep up with updates about like the podcast and that kind of thing is my Instagram, which is @freddy.mcconnell. And then the film is seahorsefilm.com. That's actually being released in the US in June. That is available to buy on Vimeo at the moment in the UK or everywhere else.
It is. It is a bargain price of $3.99, everyone. Yeah. Go and watch it. It's so, so touching.
Brilliant. Well, Freddie, as Lex says, we have to reiterate, community are always here to try and listen, to try and share the voice of people who may not be heard. And I hope that the community listeners really get behind you and support you in any way that you can. Thanks so much for having us, and all the best in the future.
Awesome. Thank you very much. That was great. Cheers.
So that was Freddie McConnell that you just heard. I cannot be grateful enough for him for his patience with us for when we needed to really learn things. And it is that thing. Sometimes it's not easy to learn because, as you heard, we get things wrong. And so it's so amazing when someone is patient and kind and shares their knowledge and their journey. So thank you, Freddie, for sharing that with all of us. And I didn't realize when I first heard his story just the impact that that could have for all queer parents. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think for me, speaking to Freddie really made me realise how much we really do need to get used as a community to saying, I don't know enough about this, and being open to really listening and learning from each other. It's just sort of made me even more fired up to want to join that cause, I suppose, and sort of fight the good fight, although that sounds really cheesy. So I know that next week on Alphabet Radio, I am recording my show with my lovely girlfriend Grace Agony Wives. Mm-hmm. So I'm super excited, but I know I said I was super tired, but she is 100% ready to go. She has been on at me, and I know people have been sending in loads of questions and queries. What's up next for you, Lex?
I think the first thing that's coming up for me is to listen to King Princess. Thank you for that, Swap It Like It's Hot recommendation. And otherwise, I'm going to get a bit more of my bacon. I've recently picked up baking. I'm a failure so far, but that's what I'm going to do to keep through this lockdown.
I'm here for it. I literally, if you can bake, I want to see it live on Instagram. That is my challenge for you. Also, guys, don't forget to drop us a DM. You can slide in the DMs at Alphabet Radio if you want me to teach Lex a TikTok dance, because I feel like that should definitely happen. Don't forget to listen back live. You can download the podcast right after you've listened to the show. I think it will be live the next day. Is that my correct, Lex?
Yeah, that should be right. About Friday. So it should be coming out on all podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get them. And please don't forget to give us a 5-star, subscribe, leave a little lovely review, and tell your friends.
Tell your friends about us. And in the meantime, stay safe, stay kind, and stay queer.
See you, everyone. Bye.